Okay.
The conference is now being recorded.
Okay, so we are recording this call, so it will be placed on the website, but you're more than welcome to use this PowerPoint if you want to do a brown bag with your own volunteers or with your circuit. So as you guys know, I'm sure by now, we were, and Alan and, you know, many of the youth who testified and our volunteers that testified were instrumental in getting the new normalcy legislation passed. And I know that we've done a couple of different seminars and a couple of different trainings on it, but now that the law is in effect and we are working towards implementing the law, we thought it would be a good idea to go ahead and have another training on the law so that you guys are equipped with the best tools to enforce the law as it exists. And so the purpose of this training is to help you understand the law, help you recognize and remove any barriers that might exist, how to deal with frequent issues, and then other special considerations. If you are following along, I'm now on the second slide of the presentation. And I am going to jump now for just a minute, and I know that Alan will join in here jump in with his insights as to how the legislation was passed and sort of the history. But I think it is important for you guys to have that context and to understand that this has been in the works for a long time. Back in 2005, there was a memo from Secretary Haiti about normalcy. And even then, it was considered something that we were just starting to really talk about and really start to address the issue. But she, Secretary Haiti, in that memo, had met with youth and recognized that this was a problem because the problem is that, when the children do not have, of course, the ability to participate in things such as school sports and field trips and sleepovers, then they have, that of course is going to negatively affect their behavior, negatively affect their ability to bond and to assimilate into society once they, age out of foster care or even while they're in foster care to get along with their peers and to be successful in school and other activities. So,
it's interesting. I met with Lucy Haiti at the time that we were considering this bill. She was in an adult living facility, and we discussed it. And she told me this was the first memo where normalcy really became an issue. And she had met with a number of kids in foster care. And one of the kids who was in the band couldn't go on a field trip because they wouldn't permit her because she was in foster care. And Lucy had been in a band when she was growing up, and it had a real big impact on her. And she had written the memo about normalcy and what her expectations were. And, she recognized during this in the memo that obstacles to normalcy cause children to exhibit inappropriate behavior and may cause dangerous activity. So she was on the cutting edge of the problem, realizing it, and basically told her staff to redo the rulemaking to address normalcy and make it clear, and she gave guidelines with detailed examples. The goal of the memo was to find ways so kids can do things, not how they cannot do things. And she had focused on teens and made it effective immediately. But as we all know, the memo was in paper, but in practice, it did not happen. Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, I was going to say, and it really was 5 years. I was shocked to learn that it was 5 years before we had really any sort of additional effort in this area, and that was with Secretary Sheldon's normalcy memo, which and those of you who have been with the program for a while will remember, that quality parenting initiative and Secretary Sheldon's efforts to encourage us to think about the cases differently and encourage foster parents to be more of parents instead of placements. And Alan, I don't know if you, I know you were, of course, working for the department then, and if you would like to talk about your involvement with that memo.
Yeah, it was a big problem for Secretary Sheldon because he talked to kids all the time. I mean, everywhere he went in the state, he would meet with youth and listen to them. And I think that is where he started realizing that even our language was problematic. You know, we used words like placement instead of homes. And we talked about foster children as if their status defined them. And we started seeing, in fact, you'll probably never hear me use the word foster child, but I'll say child in foster care, the Children First Initiative, that it's about the children. And at the time, Carol Schoeffer, who was at the time preparing to sue the Department of Children and Families, Secretary Sheldon asked her, instead of suing me, why don't you help me? And that's where her whole quality parenting initiative came from, because we realized that these children really needed parenting. And at that point, we started focusing on the children being parented and the people in those roles, caregivers' roles, making decisions. And the memo that Secretary Sheldon wrote 5 years after the Lucy Haiti memo was entitled Stop Calling Us Foster Kids. You know, they wanted to just be called kids. He recognized the stigma associated with being called foster kids instead of just kids, and he realized, he tried to work within the framework and was going to define normalcy within the balancing test of the language in the statute, because at the time, the statute required balancing normalcy and safety. He was clear that all children deserve normal lives and referred to them as kids, children, or teenagers from then on, and gave clear guidance with foster parents making the decisions. The vision was clearly outlined and included all children, not just teenagers. So we saw that first addressing of this is every child. This isn't just the teenagers who were talking to Secretary Sheldon, but also the little kids that we knew they needed normalcy just as much as everyone else. And at the time, he created a position called the Normalcy Czar, and he had put me in that position to answer questions on normalcy. And we did it all the time. And so you'd have on the website different questions that come up, that would come up, and answers that the department believed was the correct answer. The problem was it just didn't get implemented. Still, we kept hearing the story after story because of the liability concerns that the caregivers, who brought this issue up a lot, could not do the things they wanted to do with their children without the getting court orders, or not being able to do it because of the concern of liability. And it kind of made sense, because if the providers were making the decisions, and a simple question like, can we take little Joey to the beach? And the providers talk to their attorneys and they go, should we let him go to the beach? And you're balancing safety and normalcy. Going to the beach, the child could drown, safety wins. So what we saw was, across the board, the decisions were being made that were conservative, that actually took away normalcy, but may have protected liability for people who weren't the caregivers of the child making the decisions.
And that really leads us to the memo from Secretary Wilkins, and that was in 2012, which was really the stepping stone for Alan and for our program to get the ball rolling with the legislation. Secretary Wilkins was very clear that saying no is not the best way to do it. You have to instead manage the risk. And I think, too, for those of us who are parents, I mean, that's what you do as a parent as well, is that you manage the risk. And so it was really with that memo and the, you know, the again, the history and the support that's been building over the years, and also the voices of the youth, making their way finally to the legislature, you know, via our office and other means, that we were able to get this on the legislative agenda with the Voice Heard report and through other means. Alan, do you want to talk about that for just a little bit? How the
yes.
legislation was passed.
The I wish Kiera was on. Is she on yet? Because in reality, the youth were defining where we went. Youth Shine, in particular, was very vocal. In January 2012, when Secretary David Wilkins wrote his memo, his was the shortest of all memos. I mean, his was very short, got to the point. The key theme there is he said, saying no is no way to manage risk. And that hit the nail on the head. But this is the first time that the liability issue was taken on, you know, straight and front and center as the issue. The theme became parenting, and that the true thing wasn't normal. It wasn't the normalcy activities. It was actually the parenting issues. The caregiver has to make decisions as a reasonable, prudent parent, because in reality, these children needed guidance, and you really don't get guidance when you have to go through an organization bureaucracy to find out day-to-day decisions on what you can and can't do. Secretary Wilkins actually believed the rule was consistent and we could actually do normalcy. However, the providers were still saying no and concerned about liability issues. The Guardian Ad Litem program got very engaged in it because we did a survey of children in foster care and Guardian Ad Litems about what their concerns were. It was called The Voices Heard, and we do this report every year where we basically learn from youth in foster care and our volunteers who interact with those kids, especially the nonverbal kids, and know a lot about what's going on. And the key priority was the kids just wanted to be kids and they wanted to have normal activities. We heard the same story that Lucy Haiti heard some 7 or 8 years ago. And so after discussing with the youth, we decided the key was to do something aligned with what California, who was the other state that tried to address this, by having a reasonable, prudent parent standard for the caregiver and take the decision-making away from people that didn't know the child and weren't in a good position to make make a decision and couldn't make decisions real time. And so that's where the whole idea of the reasonable, prudent parent standard came in, understanding that there would need to be protections that this person making the decisions as a reasonable, prudent parent wouldn't be sued every time something went wrong, as could happen in any family. And so they also prepared some liability protection as long as the caregiver acted as a reasonable, prudent parent. That happened actually in March 2012. And in April 2012, the Fostering Florida's Future Committee, created by Secretary Wilkins, led to some formal support of it so we could have all the individuals involved in the system, because it had Foster Parent Association, community-based care providers on this committee. And it didn't take long to get consensus that the GAL program would take the lead in coming up with a legislative proposal.
Okay. Well, and now I'm going to switch back to the PowerPoint that we have distributed, unless, Alan, there was anything else about the history of what got us here today that you wanted to add.
Well, let me say this. You know, we picked, of course, Senator Dietert from the Senate in August 2012 to be the sponsor. She had been the sponsor of Road to Independence and has been the leader in the Senate of child welfare issues that try to help foster kids out. And we also chose Representative Ben Albritton, who was so moved when he met volunteers in Polk County that he basically came to us and said he wanted to do anything for these kids. He believes in the GAL program and wants to be the champion for something that we believe in. And so those two became the sponsors and took it from there. There were numerous hearings, and volunteers around the state came up and testified. Youth, more than 40 youth from around the state came up and testified in all the committees. This bill, through all the committees, never got one no vote at any point. And leading up to a signing of the bill on April 11, 2013, where Governor Rick Scott, who supported it throughout, had a signing ceremony where foster parents and youth in foster care were there to celebrate this major change in how what kids are allowed to do in foster care. And before we get back to the PowerPoint, I'd like to quote Senator Nancy Dietert in her testimony before the U.S. House Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Resources in 2013. They had asked her to go up there with a number of other people from around the country to talk about changing the law nationally based on Florida's new normalcy law. And she said during that hearing, and I quote, "The foster care system has historically been focused on safety and concerns about liability, and this has often created huge barriers to the normalcy of a child's experiences growing up. Liability issues are particularly acute in Florida because we have privatized the provision of foster care and other related services. As a result of the emphasis on safety and those liability concerns, children in care typically miss many rites of passage common to their peers." I think that really lays the groundwork for what happened. And when the governor signed it and it went into effect July, we are already getting feedback because we're doing this year's Voices Heard that it has had a major impact on children in their foster parents, in the group homes, in those youth being able to do regular activities like their peers. So now I'm going to hand it back to Mary Kay, but before I do, I just wanted to say I appreciate all of you and your interest in this. I know it's important to you, to each of you, because when I go around the state, this is what I hear about, the frustration. And when I'm a GAL on a case, as I take a case every now and then, the frustration of having to do such things like have a staffing so a 17-year-old child can go on a date or get a learner's permit. So, Mary Kay, I'm going to turn it over to you now to go through the PowerPoint. But again, I appreciate what each of you are doing to help these kids have normal lives.
Thank you, Alan. And Alan, feel free to jump in too as I'm talking.
Okay.
You know, with anything you want to add. And we've been trying to get Kira on the phone. Kira, are you there? We're texting her now because her voicemail is full and she's not responding. So something must have come up. She was, as of yesterday.
I think that's normalcy. That happens to my kids, too. So I think we're going to count this as a normalcy activity.
Typical teenager. But what I'd like to do is to try and get her back, have another call, because I do think you guys would really enjoy hearing from her. So, and that was a beep. I heard a beep. That wasn't Kira by any chance, right? Okay.
Yeah.
So, that is me. Oh, Kira. Yay. Great.
Okay, let me say this before Kira talks throughout this presentation. She is really represents why this had success. As I said earlier, we had over 40 children from USHINE and other kids come to Tallahassee and talk about their experience in foster care. And what we learned is, and especially being the GAL program, whose only mission is to ensure these children have a voice and their best interest is advocated for, that when they have the ability and can speak, they can make things happen. And these youth had a dramatic impact And most of the kids that testified weren't even testifying for themselves because they had aged out of foster care. But they were talking so the people that followed them, their brothers and sisters, would have the normalcy lives and that they could be kids just like every other kid that they didn't have. So, Kiera, I want to thank you personally for doing this today and all your colleagues that also testified. And you are the expert, so I'm going to shut up.
Yeah. Well, and what I'm going to do then is just really quickly, I'll run through the law, which is what the PowerPoint is, and then hand it over to Kiera. So I won't spend as much time on that so that we can still finish at the lunch hour, but I want to give as much time as possible to Kiera. Slide 2, removing barriers to normalcy, is standard 9, which is one of our guardian ad litem standards, which is on page 25 of the standards. And I think it's significant to point out that, you know, the guardian ad litem shall advocate to remove barriers. So it's very clear that our policy is that we expect the program and the volunteers and the staff that support the program to be zealous advocates in this regard and on these cases. And, you know, when we find out that a child can't go to the beach or isn't allowed to do a sport they want to do, then we need to be the zealous advocate that is pushing for that activity. And we want, and that, again, is the reason, one of the reasons why we're doing this training is we want you guys to have that tool so that you can do that effectively. So, slide 3, what is the law? The caregivers have to use, as Alan mentioned, that reasonable, prudent parent standard to determine if it's an age-appropriate activity. And then on slide 4, we give you the actual definition, which is, and I'm not going to waste time reading it to you, but I want you to read it. I mean, it's a common sense definition of what you would think a reasonable, prudent parent standard would be. But that is a standard you need to apply if you are challenging a caregiver or the, you know, your CBC on what you feel is an unfair practice or in a way that normalcy is not being addressed. Moving on to slide 5, we bullet point there the different things that the caregiver should consider about the child. Of course, the age and maturity, the risks of the activity, best interests. The importance of how it will affect the child's emotional and developmental growth. Is it going to give the child a family-like living experience? And then, of course, you do have to consider the behavioral history of the child, and you do have to have that safety element. But, again, that is one of many factors. So,
Can I break in on this real quick? That is important that you depend on their factors as children. Some of the therapeutic group homes and medical foster homes had this initial view that it didn't apply to them because of the kids' special needs. That is not the case. Their normalcy may allow them to do different activities because of their medical complexity, but if you happen to be in a medical foster home and you have asthma, all of a sudden the CBCs aren't making the decision or the providers. It's still going to be the caregiver, but she's going to take into consideration what the doctors say and stuff. And I think that's very important because we wouldn't want children who may have some disabilities to be treated as second-class citizens and not get the parenting that this bill is all about. So that's something as GAL staff we may identify and need to escalate if we find, for instance, a child in a therapeutic foster home may not be able to have, may have to use a respite care from a background-checked foster parent when there may be someone suitable that could be good that may not have those requirements and may even have someone come to their house and watch the child, which is actually prohibited according to the old rules. So I just wanted to highlight this applies to all children based on those things that Mary Kay said in there. We are not going to treat children with disabilities and medical complexities different. They get to be kids too.
Okay, moving on to slide 6 is the specific law on liability. And this is important, I think, in that just a reminder that the caregiver, your guardians will be dealing with caregivers who will say, well, what about, they may ask them about the liability. And again, it comes down to that reasonable and prudent standard. So if the caregiver is letting the child go to a party where they know there will be alcohol, then that, of course, is not a reasonable and prudent standard. But if it's a sleepover with a friend or a party with a friend's family where they know the parents, they've confirmed that the parents will be there, you know, they've done the rational things that a reasonable parent would do, then they will be covered under the standard. Moving on to slide 7, you know, a problem historically has been that for the children who are in group homes or shelters, there wasn't an identified person to get permission for these extra events or to be responsible for making these decisions. So the law requires that there has to be an identified caregiver to make normalcy decisions, and there's no exception for the group homes or the shelters. Moving on to slide 8. The caseworker cannot require, or the department can't require prior approval for a child to participate in an activity. So what that means, and what your role should be as an advocate, is if a caregiver is not being permitted to make the decisions, then you need to inform the department or the court. And I would urge you, I mean, this is where the attorneys can be especially helpful in filing motions and being, again, those zealous advocates, not waiting for the 5-month judicial review. And especially in the areas where, you know, we're concerned that normalcy is not the norm, or is not something that's happening regularly in our, you know, in the group homes or in foster homes that are traditionally have older children. We really have to be the ones on the front lines filing the motions and arguing for that normalcy to be enforced. Of course, the court has to consider, moving on to slide 9, pre-existing court orders. So the normalcy order cannot contradict a pre-existing court order. So you do have to be, as the attorney, you need to be familiar with the case file, be familiar with prior orders. So what you can do in your normal, in your motion, and to, you know, and to get the court to order the whatever activity is you want to be ordered, if you're having any difficulty, you need to make sure that you've done your prep work and that you have the language in there to either correct the older order or somehow take into account that other order so you don't have a conflict. Because if there is an outright conflict, then the older order is going to control. And, of course, we have to be careful that the normalcy activities don't interfere with reunification efforts. So, and this is where your volunteers can be very helpful and creative in thinking outside of the box and coming up with ideas for how to do that. Okay, so let's move on to slides 10 and 11 are just about notifying the department if you are aware of either normalcy not being, the normalcy law not being followed, or if the reasonable prudent parent standard is not being followed. You know, it goes both ways. So if you do hear that the child is being able to go to parties where you feel the child is not being properly supervised or there's a, you know, a risk, then certainly you need to inform the department and the court. Slide 12, it discusses confidentiality. So the confidentiality requirements should not be able to restrict participation. Your order limits what your guardian ad litem can reveal to outside folks. So that may be something you need to get special permission from the court if the activity that the child wants to do requires some sort of special confidential information. You can make that happen, but you just need to do it with the knowledge of the court and with the knowledge of the department. As Alan said, slide 13 discusses disabled youth, and as Alan talked about, disabled youth have to be provided with an equal opportunity to participate in all the activities. Slide 14 is social media. They have to be able to be permitted to participate in social media. That one, I think, as a parent myself struggling with a middle schooler with social media, and I should probably get some guidance from Alan. That's a toughie in terms of how to supervise that appropriately. But again, this is where your volunteers can be incredibly helpful because they do have the time to talk to the youth about social media and explore the, you know, appropriate use of social media.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Alan.
You know, it's interesting because it's a reasonable, prudent standard test. There is a few challenges that are going to be frustrating for our volunteers and our staff. In particular, I think of a typical thing where me and my wife made to make a decision about our child on Facebook. In fact, we had those discussions about when you start Facebook, and foster parents are going to have those same discussions. And really, it depends on the individual child. But the difficult part of it is reasonable parents can disagree, which makes it really challenging. And we're really trying to give the child parenting. So it becomes difficult. If me and my wife made decisions, we'd make different decisions. We kind of come together and you know, talk with one voice. But it's going to make it challenging if a foster parent makes a decision where the guardian or our attorney would make a different decisions. The question is not, do we like their decision? The question is, was their decision a reasonable and prudent decision for that child? And that part is difficult. It may just be a bad placement. For example, let's say a kid wants to play high school football, and there's a foster parent that doesn't think high school football should be played by kids. I mean, there are some foster parents like that. In fact, President Obama said if he had a kid, he wouldn't let his kid play football because of the head injury stuff. I think it's going to make it very challenging. I think that if the CBC, which we had once a provider that said no kid could play high school football, that would be inaccurate. I mean, that would be contrary to the law. But it is possible that a foster parent may not want their child to play football. But if the child is 6'6", 280, 250 pounds, and has a chance for a scholarship, that may be a bad placement for that kid. That may have been wanted to be discussed before you place the child in a foster home that maybe a doctor that won't let their child play football. So it gets kind of confusing, but the key is every child needs to be treated individually. And from our perspective, it's not about what we believe the right decision is. It's whether the caregiver made a decision that fits in the category is would a reasonable, prudent parent, could they have made that decision?
Okay. Thanks, Ellen. It's already 12:40, and I really want to hand the mic over to Kira. So just real quickly, I'm not going to go through the rest of the slides, but I want you to read the rest of them. I'd want to point out, though, the normalcy checklist that's at the end of the presentation, that's also saved on our website, of course, but I think this is very helpful. There is one, I've gotten a few questions about one issue, the allowance. There has been dispute about whether or not the allowance can be withheld as a form of discipline. And the administrative code is clear, is that it is not appropriate for allowance to be withheld as a form of discipline. So if you are having that issue, I think that, unfortunately, it's a pretty common misunderstanding statewide. But and your volunteer may think, well, the kid's acting really inappropriate. They shouldn't get their allowance. Well, the administrative code is clear. They need to get their allowance. Even if their behavior maybe doesn't warrant it. It's a very small amount of money, so you know it's not like they're getting $300 a month or anything like that. So I just wanted to make sure that was clear, and that is on the checklist too. So with that, I want to hand it over to Kiara, and then if we have any time at the end, we can take questions. And, of course, if you have any questions about the slides I didn't go over yet, feel free to email me. Okay, Kiara, are you still with us?
Yes.
Okay, we'll hand it over to you.
Well, my name is Kiara Perkins. I'm with Florida Youth Shine. I'm the co-legislative chair on the board in Youth Shine. What am I supposed to say? I'm really nervous.
Well, we talked about how you were going to talk about your history, you know, what, you know, your experience was in foster care, and then, you know, you can also talk about your advocacy on the bill and then how you feel the bill would have enhanced your life.
Well, when I was growing up, like, when I was in foster care, it's when I was, like, younger. So a lot of stuff I didn't really, you know, like, have to do. But, like, as I got older, there was some stuff that I wanted to do. But since I was always being told no when I was younger, I just didn't even, like, see the point in asking if I could go. But I would see, like, my other, like, some foster brothers and sisters that came to live with us, they would ask if they could go somewhere, and our foster mom would tell them no. They would have to ask the caseworker and some other stuff. So it just really discouraged me from, you know, asking if I could do anything, because I always saw that my other foster brothers and sisters got told no because I'm guessing of liability issues. And so it really kind of, I don't know the word, but it just really kept me, like, from a lot of stuff. Like, when I was in high school, I went to First Coast High School, and I wanted to run for Miss First Coast, but I was just too scared to even try to do it. And then I was too scared to ask, because I was in relative care by then. I was too scared to ask my cousin if I could do anything, because she was always telling me no. And so it just being hindered from doing things, it lowers your confidence in yourself, and it just makes you feel like, you know, you can't do anything, and, like, you won't be good at it. That's why I advocated for this issue, because I know there was a lot of stuff, like, growing up, and especially in high school, where you're supposed to branch out, and you're supposed to network with people, and just, you know, you're kind of trying to find yourself in high school. And I really don't feel like I had the best high school experience because of that, you know, because I wasn't open, because I was scared to ask if I could do anything for fear of someone telling me no, that they would have to ask the caseworker, we're going to have to, you know, go through this and go through that. So it just really held me back from a lot of stuff and just kept me kind of like in the shell. So, I mean, I don't want other kids to have to feel like that. I feel like if there's something that you want, you should go after it, you know, especially if it's going to help you be successful in life, if it's going to help you in life. I feel like of course you're going to have obstacles, but, you know, the people who are put in charge of you to love and to care for you, they shouldn't be one of your obstacles that keep you from, you know, reaching your dreams. So,
Kira, what activities were you able to do any activities as a youth in foster care, or basically go to school and that was it?
This school, the only activities that I pretty much did was, like, the activities that the Foster Parent Association put together. Like, they would have little carnivals and stuff like that. But, you know, after a while, I wasn't interested in that stuff anymore. You know, I wanted to hang out with friends. I wanted to, you know, go to the pool with my friends, go to the beach, you know, go to the park and stuff. And I just wasn't allowed to.
So, and that was sort of my next question, was what activities would you have wanted to do? Is the main thing that you felt you were missing out on was that interaction with your friends?
Mm-hmm. Like, in the neighborhood that I lived in, there was a community pool, like, right up the street. And all my friends in the neighborhood would come and ask, you know, come knocking on the door asking if I can go to the pool. And, you know, it was so embarrassing, like, for my foster mom to come to the door and say, oh, no, she can't go to the pool. You know what I'm saying? And it's like, I can't go, but there's no explanation as to why I can't go, you know. So after a while, I just stopped asking, you know, if I could do anything, because the answer was always no.
And were you in a group home, or were you in a foster home, and how many other children were in your...
No, I was never in a group home. I would say at the most, there was three of us at the most in my foster home, three kids.
And did your foster mom, did she assist you with, or your caseworker, did anyone assist you with practicing driving or doing what you needed to do so you would be able to drive once you were old enough?
Actually, I learned how to drive from this girl at my school. I used to, I know this is bad, but I used to, like, stay after school. Like, when I said that I was going to, like, tutoring or something, I was actually going with my friend, and she would, like, teach me how to drive in the parking lot at school. So I learned from my friend.
You did that all on your own. Did you, do you have a license now?
Yeah, I got it when I was 18. Like, when I was, after my foster mom realized that I told her I knew how to drive, and she let me, like, show her that I know how to drive. She kept telling me that she was going to get me a license. She was going to go take me to get my permit, but she never did it. And then when I left her house, I went into relative care, and my cousin kept telling me that she was going to take me there to go get the license, but nobody ever, like, took out the time to, you know, do it. So once I turned 18, I had to go and do it myself.
And what about vacations? Did you ever go or on any trips? Did you ever go anywhere other than basically school and home to the foster home?
I went on... Not when I was in foster care. Once I got to relative care is when I actually went somewhere. But when I was in foster care, I didn't go anywhere. I didn't know anything else but Jacksonville when I was in foster care.
And what about the allowance? Were you given an allowance?
Mm-mm.
Not right. So your foster mom never gave you an allowance?
Mm-mm.
Well, I know you've talked a little bit about why you think the bill is important. Is there anything else about the legislative process of participating in that you'd like to tell everyone on the call?
Well, I did advocate for the normalcy bill. I think only once. And that's just when I was last year, and I just, basically just told the legislators what, you know, I'm saying now about how I wasn't really, you know, allowed to do anything. You know, I was, like, kept, like, housed in this little bubble, you know, like, just knowing the bubble. You know, I didn't know, you know, anything other than that, you know, and it really is not fun being in a bubble.
Well, what I'd like to do now is just take everyone is on mute, so they can't ask you questions if they want to, but I'm going to take everyone off mute now, and then we'll see if anybody has any questions, okay?
Patient mode is now disabled.
Okay, so you should be able to talk now. Does anyone have any questions for Kiera or myself or Alan?
I do.
This is Roberta in Circuit 19. Hi.
Yes. Hi, Roberta.
My question here is, you were talking about how they can't take away the allowance as a punishment. Can they take away the cell phone as a punishment?
I took away my child's cell phone as a punishment.
Yeah, I mean, I think that probably is fair game.
But you could also take away the allowance, so I'm just wondering if it's different.
No, I mean, the allowance, I would caution...
I meant for Alan's own child.
Right, yes.
Right.
there's a law that says the foster parent cannot deprive the child of the allowance. So
okay.
I think
and it's almost like a statutory interpretation. If you have two laws that are inconsistent, you try to read them consistently. If you, they actually have something about the alliance, the allowance stuff.
Okay.
But
thank you.
Of course, the foster parents, of course, can. I mean, they have to be able to discipline the child in a way that's appropriate. I mean, by discipline, I mean withhold. You know, if they need to take away screen time or whatever. I mean, certainly the foster parents have to be able to do that.
Okay.
This is Kay James from the Eighth Circuit. Can you, somebody walk us through how you would envision us being able to get kids to get driver's ed? Who does it? Who pays for insurance for the car? Does the foster parent have to allow the child to use their own car? I mean, how does this work in actuality?
We've actually identified when it comes to driving, you know, it may be normal, but there may be other obstacles, primarily financial. It is a big problem. Only 2-3% of the children turn 18 and drive. So this year we actually have a bill sponsored by the same legislators that sponsored the normalcy bill that will address it. So severe pilot. And what it's going to do is funding of somewhere between $800,000 and $1.5 million that can reimburse the cost of things associated with getting a driver's license, taking driving education, things like that. Also, it will pay for the difference in insurance if a foster parent or someone or some other adult gets insurance for a child, that the difference between what they paid and the additional cost would also be refunded till the money run out, of course, because it's a line item budget that we're trying to seek. Also, for those kids that can't get someone to put them on their license or on their insurance, it removes the disability of non-age, which means the judge can allow them to get insurance as a person under 18, and it be lawful, and that would be reimbursed. And lastly, it prioritizes youth in foster care to get prioritized in high school to get into the driving class, because we know they're at a disadvantage with kids moving around all the time in foster care. That oftentimes what I hear and what everyone else has heard is they can't get into that class because there's always a wait list. So that bill is on the table now. It's in the House and Senate. And, in fact, next week it's going to be heard. It's the third committee in the Senate in front of the Insurance and Banking Committee on Tuesday. And we're going to have youth again and volunteers again come and testify about the issue driving in foster care and why that you really can't be independent when you turn 18 unless you can drive. And the bill is called the Keys to Independence Act.
Alan, one more question. Do you know if there are insurance companies that actually will make insurance available to foster kids who have the age disability removed from them?
We actually have talked to some of the lobbyists from the insurance companies. They could care less about the individual. I'm not going to say that. They use an actuarial table. They look at the kids and they come up with a number. They don't get into the nuances. I understand that they would. In fact, there is a statute right now that lets youth do it in some Chapter 600 series, but I don't think anyone knows about it or utilizes it. So we wanted to put it in a place where our youth would be able to know about it and take advantage of it.
Okay.
What we did when we looked at the issue and interviewed foster parents, group homes, and Youth Shine and other children in foster care or recently aged out of foster care, that some of the ability to do this, like examples, case manager signing so a youth could get a learner's permit, that they are protected from liability in another statute. A lot of it will be education. What the legislation will do if passed will create a nonprofit that not only reimburses people for those costs associated with getting kids driving, but also provides technical assistance around the state to those organizations to help them improve at it.
Good. Sounds good. Good
question, though. I hope it passed. You know, we'll let you know about it. If you want to, you can come up and testify for it if you know of a child in foster care that had that problem. I know that virtually every kid has that problem. In fact, when I meet with kids that are 20 and 21 that aged out of foster care, some of them still don't drive. In fact, at the last hearing, AAA testified in support of the bill because they said it was a safety issue. Because what happens is when they can't turn 18 and finally get a license, the first time they're doing it is on their own, and that's pretty dangerous. We really need to get them get a learner's permit and go through the process so they can be safe drivers.
This is Diane Bernard in the Sixth Circuit. I had a child recently spend the night at a friend's home, and the case manager went to the home, introduced herself to the mother, and asked for a walkthrough before she would allow the child to spend the night. And I didn't really feel that that was normalcy, because I might call the mother when my kids were growing up, but I never asked for a walkthrough.
I agree with you, and I've heard similar instances from the 13th Circuit on haircuts recently. I think what I would do is let your director know and try to set up a meeting with the Eckerd CEO. It might be a subcontractor that isn't educated about the law. I definitely say that that would be contrary. I would never, I couldn't imagine that. But that's what we were trying to get away from, the humiliation and the stigma associated with foster care.
Right, right.
Sierra, you probably know better. I mean, that probably would have been pretty embarrassing for you. I mean, you said it all when you talked. You stopped asking to do things because of the embarrassment.
Are there any other questions? Again, you're welcome. Go ahead. I hear someone.
I have one for Kiara Perkins. Did you have a guardian ad litem? I know this was a little time ago, but did you have one when you were in the foster care or residential care? I mean, relative care.
If I had one, I knew nothing about them. I was left out out of a lot of the processes and stuff. Like, I had no idea that they were going to court. I had no idea that I was allowed to go to the hearing. You know, it was a lot of stuff that I was left out of and that I had no knowledge of until it came closer time for me to age out of foster care. So I have no idea.
Okay, thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. This is Ann in the 17th. I have a question about the allowance, which I think is pretty clear, but can group homes require the children to earn allowance based on a point system of following roles, et cetera?
I don't think that they can. And Alan, jump in here if you disagree, but I think they have to give them the minimum allowance regardless, because that point system is, a method of discipline. But I think that they could potentially allow the children to earn more money as part of an incentive program, over the allowance. But I think the code is clear that they have to receive the allowance, the monthly allowance.
Okay. Thank you.
Do you disagree, Alan? Or
I hadn't really thought it through, but it sounds right.
Mary Kay, this is Mike White, Eighth Circuit. I was wondering about the parents' voice in all of this. Do the parents have a voice in saying no to their kid going out of state with the foster parent for a vacation, or say no to a haircut, things like that?
Well, I think it depends.
That's a really good question. That is one of the issues that came up when we did Voices this year, and we're going to issue a report next month on what we've learned since the law was implemented. what we have heard about is parents trying to undermine the foster parents or group homes any way they can by interfering in their parenting. I would say it's always good to include the parent if, of course, if the rights are terminated, you're not going to, but because they need to also learn parenting too. Again, when it comes to day-to-day reasonable, prudent parent decisions, I would say they should be the foster parent or the caregiver of the group home should, especially when it comes to things like group homes, unless there's something very unique about the child's religion or something like that. It's child by child, but the stories I've heard about haircuts is really about the parents, the biological parents, wanting to control and not whether the child should or shouldn't have a haircut. But I would say it's child by child, and, you know, we'll be – one of the things we recommended is that DCF, as they produce the rule, that they address that in their rulemaking, because they haven't promulgated a rule yet, and the law requires them to do that. But when we did the voices and heard things from people around the state, kids, volunteers, foster parents, we're actually identifying those things that should be in the rule, and that includes the traveling out of state. I think that a lot of it could depend on the circumstances. I think the rules are going to be different for North Florida, where they're so close to Atlanta and Georgia when it comes to crossing state lines, than someone in Miami who may want to go to even another country. So, I mean, it's kind of tricky, but I hope the rules will address some of those issues. And when you get the report on the voices this year, you will see some guidance from us during that. We're actually writing the report right now. Good question, though.
This is Lorenzo Pope from the 18th Circuit in Seminole County. I want to inquire about children that destroy property, be it a group home or foster home. Are they allowed to take the destruction of property out of their allowance, or is that allowable?
Well, that's an interesting question. I would want it to be, I think the court could potentially order the child to reimburse the group home. But I would not want to be supportive of that unless it was happening through the court's knowledge and agreement.
This is Tony Mandalillo over in Circuit 7. Hello.
Yes, we're here.
I used to do licensing of foster homes and group homes in Volusia County. As far as that thing with destroying property, I think you're right, the group homes can't just take the money from the kids' allowance. I still think there's something where that probably pertains to group homes, just like it does foster homes, where they can send something in and get reimbursed for property damage. There's a provision for that.
Right. They could. I would think that they could get reimbursed by the CDC, but then also in terms of, you know, I don't know that many would have an objection with there having to be some sort of restitution by the child if the child was in a position where they could earn funds to pay it back. I mean, I think it'd have to be a case-by-case analysis. If it's a child that's, you know, has severe emotional problems, then that child is not going to have the means to pay it back, and that's, you know, part of the risk in having a home. Well, we have gone 5 hours. All the questions have been great. Are there any other questions before we hang up? Thank you so much, Kiera. We really appreciate it. And thanks, Alan. This will be on the website. So if your folks were not on the call, Kelly will send an email typically when it goes up, but it'll be up probably next week.
Thank you, everyone.